and we just hit this here. And, yep, that's it. All right. Good deal. All right, Joe Friel is the author of international bestseller books, the Triathlete's Training Bible and the Cyclist Training Bible. By helping national federations set coaching standards in training, Joe has used his science and experience to help athletes and coaches of all levels. Through Joe's hands-on instruction and rigorous continuing education, Training Bible Coaching maintains a staff of coaches throughout the world that is current on the latest and most effective and efficient training methodologies. I could keep going on and on about Joe. I also like to call him Joe For Real because he is the real deal. So with that, I welcome Joe For Real to the call. How you doing, Joe?
I'm doing well, thank you, Kerry.
Good, good. All right, first question I have for you is basically, can you explain why periodization is important in developing a strong triathlete? And by periodization, I mean the Eastern and Russian block type of periodization.
I've been working with periodization since the 70s. I didn't know what it was when I first started playing around with it back then, but it has certainly evolved over the years. It was used to be really a quite simple system, which has become much more complex. As you mentioned, it's originally based on what Eastern European athletes were doing, especially German and Russian Soviet athletes back in the 60s, 70s, and into the 80s. And it began to be picked up by Western athletes in the 70s. At first, just a very few athletes, and then by the 90s, essentially every athlete in the world was using some form of periodization. I use periodization in a kind of a broad definition, I guess. I define it as the management of stress relative to time. And so essentially anytime you start talking about how training stress is going to be meted out over the course of a period of time, like a week or a month or a year, we're really talking about periodization when we do that. So everybody athlete is working on some way of kind of trying to organize their training stress, their workload, and really that's what Training Bible is all. I mean, training periodization is all about.
Good deal. There's some other people out there now who are starting to use different models of periodization, or they're coming up with new theories on how it all works, and they're emphasizing more intensity than anything, and they're using more reverse periodization. So I just would like to know your thoughts on that and what you think about that.
Well, I guess it comes down to how we define periodization, linear periodization. I'm afraid it's usually defined as using high volume initially and then high intensity later on as we get closer to the races. It doesn't have to be that way. What it really means is that we're making the, as we get closer to the races, as we move in time toward the races, the workouts become more like the races. And so if the race is going to be an Ironman, let's say, where the intensity is actually quite low relative to what the athlete could do for a shorter distance, we actually can do what people are calling reverse periodization, which means we do high intensity in the base period and lower intensity with emphasis on volume in the build period. That's basically what I do with most of the Ironman athletes I coach, is just that very thing. So it really comes down to our definitions. But so long as we're always moving toward making the workouts more like the races, we're following good periodization theory and modeling, and the athlete should do quite well. If we're doing something else, if we're making the workouts less and less like the races as we get closer to them, then we're doing things that are counterproductive to the athlete performing well.
Okay, great. And one of the things that people ask a lot with training and coaching and things is how much volume and how much they should do as an athlete. So how do you judge that when you coach people?
It's always a tough issue when you first start coaching somebody, trying to figure out how much volume they can handle. Starting point, simply to look back at what they've done in previous years, especially the more recent years, see what they were doing then and how that impacted performance. What I find is most athletes, if given enough training leadway, in other words, they don't have a job, for example, which is common with retired athletes, or in some cases even with younger athletes, especially pros, if given enough leeway, they will tend to do too much. They'll essentially take it to the level that at which they're really not performing well at all anymore, and simply dragging themselves through workouts. If they start doing that, if they become simply zombies going out and doing workouts, there's really not going to be any value come from that. We need to make sure we're trying to get the right amount of volume, and there's really no way I can give an athlete a number that really satisfies every athlete using a formula. But essentially, if the athlete finds themselves finding it difficult to get through workouts and finding that that they're tired most of the time, then they're probably doing too much and need to cut back.
And what are do you have any specific things that you look for in an athlete to tell if they are in fact doing too much, other than some of the things you were saying there? Any specific things you look for?
Well, it's hard to, again, this is stuff that's really hard to nail down.
Yeah.
Because essentially every athlete needs to overtrain at some level. If you aren't overtraining, you're just going to be in good shape at the highest levels. The question is, how often do you give yourself rest to shed some of the fatigue that's being built up by the attempt to overtrain? Going beyond about probably 3 weeks for most athletes will lead them down the path to overtraining. So what I look for is after, what I like to see is after 2 weeks, the athlete is still performing well in their training, still workouts are still pretty sharp. But by the end of the third week, they're aware that they're tired, and we're starting to see a little bit of degradation in performance, and that tells me we're probably at the right volume and right intensity also when I see that happening, and therefore it's time for a recovery period to shed that fatigue.
All right. Good. All right. And what are your thoughts on running technique and how to develop it? Because many athletes out there just think you just run and that's it. There's nothing to it other than just running. So what are your thoughts on that?
Every sport has some level of skill associated with it. In the sport of triathlon, swimming is the sport that has the highest level of skill associated with it. Swimming is probably as much like, more like tennis than it is like running, quite honestly. There's quite a bit of skill. In fact, skill is really for most athletes what they really ought to be spending their time working on, not fitness. And as we move to the other sports within triathlon, we find that there's somewhat less skill involved, but there's still skill involved. Running is probably the second most skill-intensive of the three sports, cycling being the least intensive of the skills, skill-based activities. And in running, essentially, if we took any other sport, let's take swimming, for example, if we told a swimmer just to go swim a lot and don't worry about your stroke or your technique, just swim lots and lots and lots and you'll get really good because you're doing that, we'd find it wouldn't work. They just would not get better. They would continue to practice bad technique and just build a crater froth around themselves as they're swimming. The same thing happens to runners, only to a lesser degree. They simply won't improve as fast as if they were to get their skills refined, so that they're making the movements of the sport in the way in which is most efficient. And we can find that if we look at the most efficient athletes who are elite athletes or the fastest athletes in most cases, we find that they have certain things they do when they run that define their movements. And they're fairly basic things that all these athletes do. They all run with a high, most all run with a high cadence. Most all run with their foot touching the ground in a fairly flat manner. They may have their heel strike the ground slightly before the ball of the foot does, but we're talking about just milliseconds. We would never see the elite athlete's foot pointing skyward. They're not back on their heels in that respect as many age group runners are. They tend to have a slight forward lean as opposed to running perfectly erect or even leaning backwards like I see some athletes do. There's a lot of relaxation as they run. So these are things that tend to define what the better runners do And I try to have the athletes I coach actually begin to train to pick up some of these same skills themselves. And we start with the most basic skills and move our way toward the more more refined skills over the course of several weeks or even several months. It takes a long time to change skills like running if somebody's been doing it for many years.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that we've had here is we've had two different speakers. We've had Danny Dreyer and we've had Dr. Romanoff, and they both, you know, emphasize, you know, a lot of the same principles, but at the same time, one of the biggest things, differences between them two is that one says you get a strike on the midfoot and the other says you get a strike on the forefoot. And there's some running coaches out there who are even saying, no, you get a strike on the heel. So in terms of foot strike, what are your thoughts on that?
For endurance athletes, I find they usually do better if they learn to have a flat foot strike, which you were calling a midfoot strike. I'm afraid they get up on the balls of their foot. In other words, the ball of the foot strikes the ground first before the heel does. I found that typically leads to some overuse injuries, especially plantar fascia, Achilles tendonitis, calf. Those things can become quite inflamed because of running that way. Running back on the heels is very definitely a good way to run if you want to run real slowly. By back on the heels, I mean the toe is pointed up in the air toward the sky when the foot strikes. Again, there can be a slight, very slight, a heel strike before the forefoot strikes the ground, but it's got to be the foot almost flat when it makes that movement. Otherwise, the athlete is going to slow down. Essentially, anytime you put your heel on the ground with your toes pointing up in the air at, say, a 45-degree angle or so, you're putting the brakes on. And so running with the brakes on is not a good way to run fast.
Yeah, yeah. And, Joe, where can people get your books and other information that you have out there?
Well, they're available in almost all bookstores I found, and online, the cheapest place to get them is at Amazon. The newest editions of my training Bibles just came out in the last 2 weeks, and Amazon got them first. And some of the other bookshops haven't gotten them yet, but I know you can get it at Amazon.
So what have you added to your newest books? Anything different?
Every book, every chapter in the book has changed to some extent. The book has grown about 20% just because there's been so much going on since I originally wrote the book. For example, power training has come a long way since I first wrote about training about 15 years ago, training with power rather. And so there's a lot in the book now on how to do that, how to train with power. There's new stuff on strength training. There's new stuff on nutrition. There's new stuff on aging athletes, new stuff for novices. So essentially every chapter has had additions and changes made.
Awesome. Good stuff. All right. And what are your thoughts on swimming technique and how to teach it out there? Because, again, you know, there's some different ideas out there on what is the best stroke to do ideally for a triathlete.
It just depends a bit on the distance the athlete is swimming. Ironman is a little bit different than, say, sprint distance. Sprint distance is going to have a lot more higher turnover and a lot more leg action than Ironman distance. So essentially, it depends what we're talking about specifically, but in general, the things I look for is having a balanced body position, which means that the hips are not sinking low in the water, which is commonly what you see with athletes when they first start the sport, is their hips are riding very low. One of the things that causes that, they tend to look up toward the wall of the pool, the next wall, in other words, in front of them, and that, and whenever you look up like that, it lowers the hips. It also makes it more difficult to breathe, by the way. So the face is pointing more toward the bottom of the pool than it is toward the wall in front of you when you're in a pool. One of the harder things to teach somebody to do is the catch movement. That's a real challenge. It's hard to describe in a conversation like this over the telephone, but when I'm working with athletes on that, there are some drills that we do to learn about the catch. Again, those are very difficult to explain here, but essentially you need to find a way to make sure the athlete understands what the catch is all about and then begins to make that movement and emphasized it very heavily over the course of several weeks to get it right. I'm working with an Ironman from British Columbia, who I just met with for the first time here about probably a month ago, and did some underwater videotaping of him, and spent a good deal of time working on his stroke, and the biggest challenge was his catch. A few other problems we need to work on also, but that was by far the biggest thing. And now 1 month later, he just sent me a video yesterday, and his catch is looking quite nice. He's really got it figured out really well. But he's just been focusing on technique ever since then. We've not done any fast swimming at all for a month. It's just been working on technique and getting the catch right. And now he's getting that right, so it's about time now to go back and start working on fitness.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And you find that when people just go back to doing the regular stroke work, the regular fitness work after just working purely on technique like that, are they quicker right off the bat, or do they have to build into it, or how does that usually work?
Well, this gentleman I'm talking about from Canada, well, I'm sure he'll be quicker. He'll start having faster times now because he's got a catch working for him, and he already had very good fitness. He was about a 1 hour Ironman swim time, and so he's not shabby to begin with. He just had a catch that wasn't real effective, and so I'm sure he'll start swimming faster times now just because we've got the catch, the place he's actually doing something with it instead of just moving his arm to the water for the first several inches.
Awesome. All right. Let's talk about basically recovery and what are some of the techniques out there that people can use to recover quicker?
Well, recovery comes down primarily to two categories. There are a few others that can be thrown on top of these, but the primary two, the ones that have the biggest impact on real recovery, are number one is sleep, and number two is nutrition. If the athlete's not getting enough sleep, they're going to recover very poorly and find it hard to train at a high level. And so one of the things I talk about with the athletes I coach is making sure they get to bed at a decent hour and getting enough sleep at night. That can be difficult sometimes because they're very busy people, as most triathletes are. They've got a 40, 50, even 60-hour a week job. They've got a family with kids, with soccer games, and all sorts of stuff going on in their lives, and they're trying to fit in 10, 15, 20 hours of training a week around all of that. And so sometimes things give, and unfortunately usually the first thing that gives is sleep. And so we need to figure out a way to make sure we can get enough sleep so that they can recover fast enough to do well in training. So that's the first step, is making sure we get enough sleep. Second thing is nutrition. What I find is that most athletes, and I should back up, what I used to find with most athletes, it's going through a change I'm seeing now, is that most athletes used to eat far too much starch in their diet. Starch is really not very nutrient dense. It's got lots of macronutrients, lots of carbohydrate, sugar basically, but it doesn't have much in the way of micronutrients, especially when you compare it with vegetables, non-starchy vegetables. So that's one of the first places I look, is to see how much starch the athletes has in their diet and when they're eating starch. I like to see starch eaten post-workout in the first 30 minutes or so. It's a good time for that, and in a window that after the workout that lasts as long as the workout did, they should also be taking in starch. And so let's say the workout was a two-hour bike ride. They've got 2 hours post-workout to get some starch in their diet that day. And then once they get to that window, it's really a good idea to back off the starch and start eating more fruits, vegetables, and lean animal protein. They'll be getting lots of micronutrients that way, and they'll recover much faster because of it.
Good deal. All right. And for people short on time, what do you suggest to optimize their training? Kind of like you were talking about, there are a lot of athletes out there quite busy with family, work, and other commitments. So how do people basically get the most out of their training?
The first thing is to identify exactly what the athlete's limiters are. And by limiters, I mean their weaknesses that stand between them and success in their next A race. So let's say the A race is a very hilly race on the bike, and the athlete is not very good at climbing. That makes climbing a limiter for the athlete. Hills are a limiter for the athlete. So the athlete needs to make sure they're spending a good deal of time every week climbing hills. If they're not doing that, if they're doing lots of other stuff and not climbing hills, they're not really wasting their time, but they could be making much better use of their time. So once the athlete knows what their limiters are, then, and you have a limited amount of time to work with, then what you have to do is make sure that the workouts you do fit into your work training week are focused on those limiters.
Okay, good deal. And how do you approach athletes who need to lose weight, or want to lose weight too, I should say?
Yeah, that comes up from time to time. What I found is, quite honestly, just having the conversation with one of the athletes I coach invariably means they will lose weight, because they're now being held accountable because we had this conversation. And bottom line is, once they know how to eat, like I talked about before, all we need to watch out for is calories in and how much training we're doing. And typically the weight begins to melt off. That's one of the advantages of having a coach, is you've got somebody that's holding you accountable for things such as that. If the athlete doesn't have a coach, is not accountable to anyone, only to themselves, it's a little bit more of a challenge. And in that case, the athlete needs to do some research so they know what it is they should be eating, get their diet dialed in right, get away from the foods that are going to tend to add fat, which is primarily starch, eating at the wrong time of the day. If they'll cut out, most athletes, if they simply cut back on their starch and sugar, they will begin to lose weight. That's the biggest challenge most athletes have, is way too much starch, way too much sugar. They start cutting back on that, they'll find they start losing weight just by making that change. If they're already doing those things, cutting back on starch and sugar, then it's going to be more of a challenge, and we need to watch many more things much more precisely. And that could be, starts a whole new conversation along the lines of things they could be doing at that point also.
Awesome. Okay, and the last question I got for you is, where do you see coaching going in the future, and some of the advances that have been made, and just where it's going and how it's going to impact coaching triathletes down the road?
Well, what I see happening as far as how we coach has to do with better analysis because of technology. When I first started coaching back, I was actually a high school coach back in the 1960s and 70s. And at that time, when I was coaching track and field athletes, really all I had was a stopwatch and a tape measure. And that was pretty much it. And that was our technology. And everything was based on how we measured it and how we timed it, which meant when you went out on the road for a runner, you really couldn't do anything at all except ask the athlete how hard the training was and how they felt. So really no technology at all. Now we've gotten to the point that I can very precisely measure how the athlete did in a workout, running or cycling. Swimming's still got a ways to go in that regard. But I can measure quite precisely, show the athlete not only what they did in training graphically displayed, but also where we could have done the workout better or the race better, how we can improve because of what the technology is showing us. And what's going to happen is that grows, is that's going to become not only just postscriptive, in other words, using it after the workout is over to see how it went, but also prescriptively. We'll be able to use similar software to prescribe training for athletes, which is largely done right now by the coach by the seat of their pants. It's kind of a gut feeling sort of thing, not very precise or measurable. But the software, once we get to that point, which is not too far away, will allow us to be much more precise in loading the athlete with stress, certain types of stress, when the stress is applied, when we back off with the stress. In other words, periodization will become something which can be done with software that helps us with all the designs for the athlete, right down to the workout and how the intervals are going to be done that day, or whatever the workout may be. So that's the direction we're going. I have no doubt we're going to be there within probably 3 years. We'll have that sort of software available to all of us, and training will become much more precise than it is right now even.
Awesome. Well, that's great stuff. And Joe, where can people get your stuff again?
Books are available at Amazon, and they can find out more about my coaching business at turningbible.com.
Awesome. All right. Is there anything else you'd like to add to that?
No, I think that's about it, Kerry.
All right. Good deal. Well, Joe, thank you so much for coming on the call with us. And that's it. Thanks, man.
Happy to do it.
All right. Awesome. Have a great day. And that's it. And same time, same place next week, guys. We will have another interview. And that is basically it. Have a good night.